This is Canadian Wealth Wisdom by Tridel to Private Wealth. My name is Kyle Taylor, and I'm joined by Brad Mull, Portfolio Manager and Senior Financial Planner with Tridel to Private Wealth. Brad joined TriDelta in 2008 and has spent the past 16 years working with a wide array of different clients with diverse backgrounds and experiences. And today we'll actually be talking about a real-life case study of a couple that Brad worked with in the past and still works with today. We'll get to share some interesting insights around what this couple's situation was, what their objectives were, and ultimately what the solutions were that Brad proposed and what the results was in the end. So welcome, Brad.
Thanks, Kyle. It's good to be here.
So I'll set the stage a little bit with the couple that we'll be discussing. So this is a rather high net worth couple, high income, certainly. You mentioned that the one of the spouses was generating income of over $500,000 a year towards the end of his career. And he was in an executive position, approaching retirement, currently in their mid-50s and wanting to retire at the age of 60. Now, certainly you and I know that there's a lot that goes into the planning process for a couple like this, or for anyone for that matter. Can you set the stage a little bit more and maybe share some further detail about this couple?
Yeah, so, high income, looking to retire. Some of their other objectives were to reduce taxation, and specifically they also wanted to leave a legacy. They have two children. At the time, there were no grandkids, but today there is. But at the time we were doing this plan, there weren't grandkids.
And you mentioned that they wanted to retire at age 60. What was their sort of target spending that they were looking to have in retirement?
Yeah, so this couple initially, so part of the process, when we gather the data for a financial plan, is to spend a lot of discussion on spending. And we have some tools that help clients sort of sort that out if they don't have their own budget. So we arrived at a number of $110,000 a year indexed to inflation. There were some capital expenses that we sort of sprinkled in along the way as well.
And do you find that was sort of a reasonable level for them at that time? Do you think it was maybe less than they could have spent, or?
Yeah, well, with hindsight, and this is not uncommon, the spending isn't lining up exactly how planned. I think they undershot their spending a little in the forecasts. Now that we have history behind us, so we've done updates of the plan to capture the more realistic spending now that they've made the transition.
And how important, you mentioned some legacy planning, how important was saving money on taxes for this couple?
Yeah, I mean, tax was a big one. I mean, at that income level, as you can imagine, the RSP room gives you limited tax savings, right? So we did look at ways that he could reduce income today. And then in their scenario, the makeup of their net worth, more than half of their investment assets were taxable. And, over a 30, 40 year projection and calculating taxes along the way, as well as taxes, at the end of the planning horizon, there was a lot of tax being paid through the estate as well. So we look to address those.
And we'll certainly get to your solutions, but I just want to make sure that we have a full understanding of this couple. So can you walk through what sort of their portfolio makeup was when they came to you, the non-reg assets, the reg assets, any pensions, what did the situation look like?
Yeah, so they're a fortunate couple. They both had some defined benefit pension plans. This executive, obviously had a lot of stock options, sort of RSU, PSU units, so it's something that you come across a lot with high-level executives. From a portfolio perspective, more than half was taxable, so they did have RSP accounts that they'd been making full use of. Their TFSAs were fully maxed, and then there was a large pool of non-registered assets as well.
And were there any surprises in the planning process that maybe was unexpected as you worked through it?
No, not really. You sort of understand, you've done this enough, you kind of know where some of the opportunities may lie. So again, as part of the process, what you do is you project forward the status quo as sort of your baseline. You make sure your assumptions are correct. You're capturing the vision for the couple. And then you start to layer on where you see the opportunity. I guess in this case, to save taxes was a big one.
Mm-hmm. And so we've talked about the objectives and the overview of the couple. So getting right into sort of the meat of the plan, what were the solutions that fit best for them?
Yeah. So first I'll say that the retirement goal was met fairly easily, right? So that's always first and foremost. You want to make sure that the retirement and the spending is fit. And then you look for the efficiencies. So on the tax side, there's two sides. There's the high annual income. And there's not a lot you can do annually. RSP obviously was being taken advantage of. We do have a structured flow-through share program that we have access to. And that effectively was going to save an additional $24,000 a year off of his income.
And can you walk through, for anyone listening who maybe not is familiar with flow-through shares, what they are and what they can do for people?
Yeah, so flow-through shares is a type of equity investment typically in mining companies in Canada. So the government incentivizes investment in the space because it's capital intensive up front. So when you buy a flow-through share, you get a deduction off of your income for the amount that you purchase. As well as various tax credits.
Okay, and I know some people, when I speak about flow-through shares, are a little surprised that the government is actually incentivizing mining, given some of what's out there in the political rhetoric. Is this something, a strategy that's been around for a long time? Is it something that you see continuing?
Yeah, it has been around a long time. It has evolved of late. I think there's more of a focus now on in additional tax incentives around critical minerals. Mm-hmm. So things that you would need for batteries for electric cars, for example.
Yeah. I'll ask you a bit of a side question off that, because we're doing this recording in early 2024, and we know that there's been a lot of budget discussions of late around the alternative minimum tax. And for people listening, that can be a big sticking point for some high income individuals. Is there a rule of thumb when using flow through shares to avoid some of that issue?
Yeah, there is. Roughly 30%, 33% of your gross income would be a guideline on how much you can purchase before you start bumping up against AMT. Now everyone's situation is different. There could be other credits and deductions that you have to factor in, but that's a decent rule of thumb.
Yeah. And always good to confirm with your accountant as well.
Absolutely,
because,
yes.
they ultimately have a good understanding of AMT and working with their clients as well. And we work closely with accountants in tandem as well with clients. So what were some of the other solutions that helped them save on taxes and kind of shore up their retirement?
If I could just go back to flow-through shares
for
one quick second, Kyle, sorry. Traditional flow-through shares, you buy them and you're owning shares of a junior mining company, which can be a volatile investment ride. We do have a special structure that's arranged through private placements that actually removes that investment risk, and we're able to just capitalize on the tax savings. So that is a bit of a unique spin on flow-through shares.
And did this individual continue using flow-through shares in through to retirement, or was just while they're working years?
For the remaining working years is where it made the most sense for him, and we took advantage of that.
Did he wish that he had used them earlier?
Yes, he did.
Okay. So getting on to sort of the other side of it was the estate legacy. What was the solution that you proposed for that side?
Yeah. So in the base plan that we projected, again, we calculate the annual taxes each year as well as potential estate taxes. And in this case, again, they had defined benefit pension plans and they had a lot of non-registered assets. So those assets actually continued to grow through the time projection, and there's annual taxation on your dividends, on realized capital gains, and then again some level of deemed disposition on death. So a strategy that works really well is to implement life insurance for your estate, and it's very powerful in terms of saving taxes.
Hmm. And do you find that that's common for high net worth families? Is it a common strategy that could be used for other families?
Yeah, I think it's great. It's a great strategy. So in this case, you can look at it as an extra tax shelter, basically, where you remove some of those assets from your taxable non-registered account, and you're putting it into a tax-sheltered life insurance policy that also pays out tax-free. So you calculate a rate of return on that under various scenarios, and it's, again, a very powerful tool.
And what ultimately did they save on taxes using that insurance policy?
Yeah, so they're in their baseline plan, or if you compare to the baseline plan, these strategies saved them just over $1.2 million in taxes. Okay, so that's over a 35-year time frame. and increased the ultimate estate for their beneficiaries by close to $3 million.
So I know their kids were rather young at the time, but I'm sure they're happy about that down the road. That's certainly very powerful, and you know, speaks to the fact that insurance can be a very important asset class for building a retirement plan and an estate plan to make sure that you're paying as little as taxes as you possibly can, right? We'll switch gears a little bit to the investment portfolio. I know you mentioned that they have a pretty significant portion of their money in non-registered taxable investments. You also mentioned the pension plans. How were you navigating the investment plan with their portfolio to make sure that they were keeping that goal of limiting taxes, but also keeping up with a appropriate rate of return that supported their plan?
Yeah. So, it starts with the appropriate overall asset mix for the clients based on both their ability and willingness to take risk. So it starts there. And then, of course, you want to drill down account by account. And it's really about asset location and where do you own different types of investments. So obviously in the taxable account, you want to focus more on deferred growth. We do have some alternative investments we use where they provide some stability to that account and they provide some income. That's very tax efficient and in some cases could be considered a 100% return of capital, which means no immediate taxation in a given year. And other tax advantage, if you use some option writing, there's some tax advantages there. So that's how you would look to fill the tax efficiency need within a broader asset allocation plan.
And how important is it to find that balance between managing the tax expectation, but also not jeopardizing return? Because as we know, there can be some trade-offs there sometimes, and it's important to keep that in mind.
Yeah, I think often I see, when people are striving for tax efficiency, what ends up happening is they put all the risk in the taxable account in the name of tax efficiency. But of course, that could mean quite a volatile ride. It could mean, in a bad year, some pretty meaningful losses there. And if you're retired and you're drawing down a good chunk of your non-registered assets to help, replace your paycheck, that could have negative effects. So you do need to balance that out, and that's why I mentioned some of the alternative investments where you can bring some stability and alternative source of return while still maintaining your tax efficiency in that particular account.
And it's a good point you raise about, the more capital gains heavy investments tend to be also more volatile, and that's not appropriate for everybody. Now this couple is a bit more insulated from an income perspective because they do have the pensions sort of forming that foundation for their retirement income. Yeah. But sequence of returns is often a risk that not a lot of new retirees always appreciate. Mm-hmm. Now again, this couple is a little bit more insulated, but maybe just generally speaking, how important is that consideration for people?
Yeah, so sequence of returns is essentially, when you're nearing retirement or in your very early years of retirement, if there is a meaningful drawback in your portfolio, it has an impact on your rate of return sort of on a go-forward basis because you're drawing on the assets. So to the degree that you can, in a particular situation, if you can align portfolio income with the withdrawal needs, you help to insulate yourself from that a little bit. Because mm-hmm. Some of that, frankly, is a luck factor, yeah. Right? Markets are going to turn, they're cyclical. When does that cycle hit compared to your timeline on retirement?
I find, too, that some people, they hear that and they immediately think, well, that's because when I retire, I need to go all to bonds and GICs. But that's not necessarily the case, as we know, because that can actually do more long-term harm than good.
Yeah.
How do you approach that conversation?
Yeah, well, it's about income, yeah. Right? Not necessarily asset mix. And I know that, generally speaking, as you mentioned, bonds and GICs are considered an income class. But blue chip dividend growth stocks can help provide income. Option writing strategies that are conservatively done can help both be defensive and at a high level of income to help support withdrawals. So it is a mix. Preferred shares, again, high dividend paying option. So it's about constructing an income cash flow portfolio.
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely. And we'll bring it back a little bit to this couple more specifically, because you mentioned off the top that the one spouse has pretty significant stock options. Now, was there any approach that you took that they were nearing retirements on how to sort of use those options? Was there any, often when you're working with people with long tenures at publicly traded companies with significant stock options, there's some attachment to shares like that. What was the conversation like around that?
Yeah, so you raise a good point. I did calculate and bring up his total exposure to the company, right? So not only was his remaining working years and the income tied to the success of the company, but he had amassed a fairly large equity position through the options over the years that had been exercised, and he had not divested himself of the stock. So we did come up with a plan to start to divest his exposures and his single name risk, if you will, in one equity company. Fortunately, in this case, he was on board with that. There wasn't too much of an attachment necessarily emotionally to the shares. So it's just a strategic way to divest and realize gains just to reduce that risk in his portfolio.
Good. Yeah, certainly being able to exercise that control with somebody who's willing to kind of shed those shares is really, really helpful in the long term. And I know, too, there's some even more recent opportunities available for people who are in similar situations where they can actually divest of those shares without realizing the gain.
Mm-hmm.
There's some fund companies out there today that allow you to transfer your existing shares into a pooled fund of other people who are doing the same thing. And instead of realizing the gain, then you actually get units of this new fund that you're now contributing to. It's not for everybody, but it's certainly more of a recent innovation that I think can be important for the right person, right?
And not well known.
Not well known. There are opportunities out there that people don't always realize until it's too late, right? Now, of course, you got in front of this couple at a really good time before retirement. Obviously, earlier is always better.
Yeah.
And you're still working with them today. How has you and I know that plans are not a one-off static event. Life happens, life mm-hmm. changes, objectives mm-hmm. change as kids get older and retirement objectives change. So maybe 5-10 years down the road, what did the plan look like? Was there any surprises that needed to be adapted to?
Yeah, we definitely did update and refresh the plan. Again, that transition into retirement is sort of your best estimate of how things are going to look. But really, there's at least an 18-month period where you settle into retirement. You really better understand where your time is going to be spent and what does that cost. Families evolve. So grandkids have come into the picture. There was an unexpected divestment of real estate that we had accounted for much later in the plan that happened earlier. So, you know, as you said, life evolves and planning, you need to monitor, you need to update. They're actually in better shape than we had projected them to be. It just looks different than we thought.
And I know people always talk about in our industry about that retirement smile and about how people often, their spending changes throughout retirements, and I don't think that's always appreciated when clients are first retiring, because they assume that, you know, if they're targeting $110,000 in spending, for instance, that they're going to spend that every year for the rest of their lives, when the reality is that there tends to be a lot more spending early on. It kind of drops off a little bit as you know, people get older, they're maybe not traveling as much because they've got grandkids in the area, and then it ramps back up towards the end of their life as some healthcare expenses.
Yeah.
So how important is it to sort of forecast those different scenarios and realities?
Yeah, and that's something that we often do in the plan, is at some point in the future, we say, well, if this is what you think your annualized lifestyle is going to cost you, what we're going to do is at some point in the future, we're going to layer on some additional expenses. Mm-hmm. We don't know what those expenses are for, but we just know from experience that, you know, costs tend to go up with healthcare, retirement homes, assisted living. So you do need to factor in your capacity for those in the future.
Yeah, the cost of assisted living is not something people appreciate in their 40s. It's something more common to really hone in on and realize what the cost there is when you're in your 60s and 70s, right?
So, yeah.
I'll ask one more question too, and it's often a focus for a lot of clients, regardless of wealth, is around the decision for old age security and when to take CPP. There can be a lot that goes into that decision. What are some of the considerations that you made, and what was ultimately right for this couple?
Yep. I mean, sometimes the decision is philosophical and it's a bit more of an art than a science, but I think generally, if you just look at the math, if you live beyond, I think, age 79, you're better to defer, because you will ultimately collect more out of the program. But there are more considerations, tax, OAS clawback. So in this case, with defined benefit pension plans, some of the stock options we were divesting, a strategy to sort of convert some of the registered accounts prior to age 72 were all being implemented. So we did defer. They retired at 60. We deferred OAS to 65. In this case, age 63 for CPP. Sometimes it seems like an arbitrary number, but you just model different scenarios in the software, and that gave an incremental benefit. Deferring longer just meant more OAS clawback. So once we got some of the capital gains triggered and some early money out of the registered accounts, that's when we started.
Yeah, it can certainly be an important piece for people, because I know it's a lot more people want to protect their OAS and make sure they're not taking it early or later, and
yeah,
that can be an important decision for a lot of people,
mm-hmm,
too, right? Now, sort of wrapping it up, I wanted to ask what ultimately brought this couple to you in the first place.
Yeah, so they, at the time, actually found me through a MoneySense listing, and their interest was a focus on a financial plan. So again, the retirement, the legacy, the tax savings. So we did engage in a planning process, which included a full review of the investment portfolio and an investment proposal with some suggestions there. And ultimately going through the process, working with me, working with some team members that I brought in to assist me, they felt very comfortable. And they saw value in having everything coordinated in one spot, and so it became more of a full service relationship that continues today.
Good to hear. And I know that's a common story that we get for a lot of clients. Of course, the plan is the foundation of a lot of what we do, but we've certainly evolved, and no one better to speak to than you about how we've evolved our offering for clients to be more holistic in that sense. So it's certainly a good story. So thanks again for joining me, Brad. That concludes this recording of Canadian Wealth Wisdom, and more specifically discussing a case study around a real life couple that Brad himself was able to help. So thank you, Brad.
Thanks, Kyle.